It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
Your behavior just hasn't been very oozy.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have two more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me!
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it. This is episode 785 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, December 4th, 2022. I am still mourning the Mets, losing the best pitcher in baseball, Jacob DeGrom, headed to the Texas Rangers for 5 years and a gazillion dollars that the Mets were not willing to give to him. I think that's a contract that the Rangers are going to live to regret. But I do wonder if Veer can still pitch. I know he's got that million-dollar arm. Maybe we can get him in there to pitch for us. Thank you to everybody who shared their Spotify Wrapped messages with me on Twitter this week. It's incredible the thousands of hours people spent listening to the podcast this year. I don't think anybody more so than Ricardo Ortega with almost 29,000 minutes logged. That is unbelievable. He just barely beat out Chris Manson for the crown this year. So thank you very much. I am humbled that you would spend thousands of, whether it's 1,000 minutes or 29,000 minutes, that you would spend hours and hours of time out of your year listening to me. I am very humbled, so thank you. If you would like to make a PayPal donation and support the show, you may do so. Go to thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link on the top of the link tree. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. So many of you, though, have just absolutely killed it far beyond that, like the hacker, Joshua Edwards, who killed it not only here but on the Dynamite stream on Wednesday night with all the super chats and the channel memberships that he was gifting to other people on the stream. That's why you gotta be part of these live streams. I'm telling you, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, you never know when jolly old St. Joshua might pop up. So Joshua, thank you. And Justin, too. Justin Hess, I don't know if he's listening right now, but thank you for the support as well. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Paul, thank you. Night Stalker, Nayef, Al Safar, Big B, Brian Becerra. Killshot, Keith Hart. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. Caleb Showtime, Lindley. New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. John Raging Mad Riffle, the 90s Vampire. Edward Valenzuela. The Dirty from the 530, Gabriel Sanchez. Shin Super Kick Akuma. Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lampier. Too Tall, Taylor Backman. And Rule Breaker, Rakesh Gordon. Rakesh, you are quite welcome. And a very special shout out to the musical mercenary himself, Hishem Dahoud. On Thursday, AEW released its Symphony Series Part 2, which is a collection of orchestral renditions of AEW entrance themes for Adam Cole, Jurassic Express, Jade Cargill, and Dark Order. Mikey Ruckus, he's AEW's resident music man, asked Hishem to compose a piano section to honor the late Brody Lee on the Dark Order's track titled Wake Up Your Mind, and everybody should go listen to it. His part kicks in around the 2-minute mark. It continues on through the voiceover from Brody Lee. Congrats to him. That I know that's a great honor to be entrusted with something like that. The album is out right now, and if you dig orchestral or symphonic work, you can follow Hishem's artist project called Rizik, R-I-Z-I-K, wherever you listen to music, to hear more of his work, which is fantastic. So again, brother, congrats. I saw that Seth Rollins paid tribute to Brody Lee last night after his match in Rochester, New York. Rochester, of course, being Brody's hometown. We're coming up on 2 years since he passed away the day after Christmas in 2020. Rollins told the live crowd he passed away a couple of years ago around this time, and this is the first time that I've been here with a microphone in my hand in this city to tell him how much I miss him and how much I love him. I just wanted to say tonight was for him. Every time we are in Rochester, in my heart, that means we are here for him. It's Saturday, and you know what that means. So do your damn thing and sing my song. So that was a very nice tribute there to Brody Lee last night from Seth Rollins. There is a ton of different things to get into here this week. Let's start with WWE, because the rumor mill is already ramping up ahead of the Royal Rumble. That's one of the things I love about this time of year. You start hearing about Royal Rumble rumors heading into WrestleMania season. Now, of course, we have the Bloodline storyline. What are they going to do with Roman Reigns and the titles? What are they going to do with Sami Zayn and the Usos, right? It's a lot of questions going into WrestleMania season. But we are inching closer, and so we're going to be hearing a lot about this stuff between now and then. WrestlingNews.co reported on Thursday that there has been talk of a Hell in a Cell match taking place at the Royal Rumble next month. Not the actual Rumble match itself, although that would be hilarious, I think, seeing bodies get chucked out of the ring left and right, slamming into the cage, piling up like garbage outside. That could be Kofi Kingston's big elimination spot this year. He gets thrown out, but the bodies are stacked so high, his feet don't touch the floor, and he climbs back into the ring. But at the Survivor Series post-show scrum, if you remember, Triple H, he just got done talking about this, how Hell in a Cell should be used as a device to blow off big feuds. Ideally, that is what you would use Hell in a Cell for. He even mentioned him and Mick Foley back in 2000 and kind of paying off, well, what was supposed to be the payoff to their feud, even though they ended up in the WrestleMania main event a month later. But that's kind of the idea behind it. So I, you know, hear this rumor, which is all it is right now, but it makes me think, what feuds right now would make sense for Hell in a Cell? Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley need to have a third match. They are one win apiece. Bobby won at the Royal Rumble. Brock won at the last Saudi show. So they're one to one right now. Now, I think you can save it for WrestleMania, but if they have other ideas for Lesnar, they can blow it off inside the cell at the Royal Rumble. What about Edge and Finn Balor? That's another option, given what the Judgment Day did to him and his wife last time we saw them. All right, don't forget, Edge had that excellent cell match with Seth Rollins last year. Maybe he can have another one with Finn Balor. Or there's Roman Reigns and Kevin Owens. The belief is that the championship match at the Royal Rumble is going to be Roman Reigns defending against Kevin Owens. This would be their third championship match at the Royal Rumble going back to 2017, and their second one in that same building in the Alamo Dome. Reigns against Owens inside the cell to keep out the rest of the Bloodline, who constantly screwed him out of the title in his other matches with Roman Reigns, would make sense. The thing is, we just saw them in a cage match at War Games. So to put them back in a cage would feel redundant. If it's me, I save Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley Part 3 for WrestleMania. And maybe you put it in a cell at WrestleMania. You can do a Hell in a Cell match at WrestleMania if you want to. Just like they did with Undertaker and Shane McMahon back at WrestleMania 32. But I would save Lashley and Lesnar for WrestleMania. Now, another match rumored for the Royal Rumble, according to WrestlingNews.co, is something that was pitched internally and is referred to as a pitch black match. Now, there were no details given as to what such a match would entail or who would be involved. It sounds like something tailor-made for Bray Wyatt, who just feels like he's treading water at this point. He's been back for 2 months now, and he has yet to have a match or do anything physical outside of a headbutt to LA Knight. He's been talking in circles. And I know they're slowly telling a story in Uncle Howdy and... But for the most part, it seems like he's saying, you know, virtually the same things every week, right? He's talking in circles. This would be for a match with LA Knight. It would have to be. My first thought was that it sounds like something cinematic, and I wouldn't think the people in the building who wanted to see Bray Wyatt live and do his entrance live would be very happy about watching him in a cinematic match on a big screen. If it's not cinematic, it sounds like a match with the arena lights turned down, and that sounds terrible. That sounds absolutely fucking terrible. I would hope that they have learned their lesson after the fiasco of red light matches with The Fiend. Nobody wants to see that. But we don't know. All we have right now is a name. We have no idea what a pitch black match would actually look like if it even happens. Maybe it's a blindfold match. That was my other thought. Right? We've seen a few of those. Maybe it's a blindfold match. It sounds like more smoke and mirrors for Bray Wyatt. That's what it sounds like. That has me worried. So we'll wait and see if that ends up happening, what that stipulation entails. But that's not the only thing that has me worried. Because the big rumor this week has to do with the Royal Rumble match itself. And an item in this week's Wrestling Observer about there being talk within WWE of The Rock being part of the show. And The Rock being part of the Royal Rumble, hey, that sounds great, right? I like The Rock. I have nothing against The Rock. But the idea, and this is said to be a pie-in-the-sky, perfect world scenario. Nothing that's been negotiated, nothing that's been confirmed. But the idea being that The Rock would enter the Royal Rumble match as the surprise 30th entrant and would win the entire thing. Now, there's said to be nothing more to it right now than that. It's just a rumor. It doesn't even sound like they have a commitment from The Rock to be even be at the Rumble at all, let alone in the match. And the only thing for sure is that Meltzer says he was told that they're finalized, and this makes sense. Even if you're not a Meltzer guy, this makes sense. This is just logic here. That their finalized plans for the WrestleMania main event need to be locked in by mid-January. And whatever The Rock decides to do, he needs to let them know by then what his decision is going to be. And that's just common sense. WrestleMania is coming up in April. It's a two-night event, right? This big event. You have the Royal Rumble at the end of January. You need to know who's going to win the Royal Rumble match in order to lock in your WrestleMania plans, right? Any idiot can figure that out. But we are rapidly approaching that point where in mid-January, we're only about 6 weeks away, maybe not even a full 6 weeks, they're going to have these plans locked in. The Rock has to let them know what he's doing. He's got to shit or get off the pot because Triple H has to put a show together here. He's got to put a main event together, a couple of main events. Now, they obviously want The Rock to wrestle Roman Reigns. They've wanted that match for years. And The Rock has been open to it. He's never said no. I'm sure he'd be willing to do it. You know, it's family, it's blood. He wanted it to be done in Los Angeles, which is why they went with Roman Reigns against Brock Lesnar again this year instead of doing it in Dallas. He wanted to wait another year, and if he was interested and could do it, he wanted it to be done in LA. Well, here we are. If they can get The Rock for one more match, Roman Reigns is going to be the opponent. It will not be anybody else. Tribal Chief against Tribal Chief. The match sells itself. It does not even need a championship. Rock showing up as a surprise in the Royal Rumble would be a big moment. And it would get that giant reaction, that huge pop, right? Except that now that it's out there, I don't think they would even do it. And this is one of those things. And it doesn't even matter whether you like the idea of The Rock winning the Rumble or not. Just forget that for a second. This is one of those things that I really wish they did a better job of keeping a lid on, because it really does ruin the moment when you read about it 6 weeks or 8 weeks in advance. It gives me content to talk about here, and we all speculate anyway. Even if this didn't come out, we would be speculating anyway for the next 6 weeks. Is The Rock going to be a surprise in the Rumble? Is Stone Cold Steve Austin going to be a surprise in the Rumble? There's been talk about him doing another match. Maybe he'll pop up in the Rumble. Imagine that reaction if the glass shatters in Texas at the Royal Rumble and nobody expects Stone Cold to walk out and there he is, right? What a moment that would be. So that's what we do. We all fantasy book and speculate anyway. But when you hear something like this, that it's actually being discussed internally and there's a chance it could happen, it does ruin the moment for you, right? It's hard to keep secrets these days. It's just the nature of how things are. It's the nature of people having the access that they have in social media and the different wrestling news sites, not just The Observer. It's hard to keep a lid on things. I appreciate it when they do have a big return and they're hiding somebody out in a bus. They fly them into a different city in a disguise, and then they drive them to the bill, whatever the case may be. I appreciate it when they do stuff like that. Because it is cool sometimes to still keep that element of surprise that, you know, I remember when I was growing up as a wrestling fan, and I was a teenage wrestling fan, and people would pop up and I didn't know about it. You know, and a lot of people are deprived of those moments today, and it sucks. But Rock showing up would get a big reaction. But I'm not sure Rock winning the Rumble would get the desired reaction, especially if you have somebody like Sami Zayn or Cody Rhodes in there at the end of the match, and they don't win, but The Rock does. This is a Batista in 2014 situation all over again, where the people badly wanted to see Daniel Bryan win the Royal Rumble. He wasn't even in the match. So they shit on Batista. Batista did nothing wrong. They shit on Batista because he wasn't Daniel Bryan. He wasn't the person that they wanted to see win the match. The better story was Daniel Bryan winning and going on to challenge for the championship at WrestleMania. Now, they got there in the end. They took a funny way of getting there. Their GPS malfunction took them to the wrong city, so they had to, you know, go out of their way to get to where their destination was, but they got there eventually. And in the process, they destroyed Batista as a babyface. And I know he was pissed about that because even he knew that it would bomb. And it did. It was a different kind of Batista bomb. Cody Rhodes is said to be recovering very well from his torn pec. He's been trying to put on some weight and some mass. He wants to get up to around 240 pounds, which would be the biggest he's ever been. He's already back lifting in the gym. When Cody comes back, he's going to be over huge. It would be impossible for him not to be, after the performance that he put in that Hell in a Cell match. The guy is, he's a made man now. He has to be the favorite at this moment to win the Royal Rumble. But you also have Sami Zayn, who he's as popular now as he's ever been in his entire career. If he's in the Royal Rumble, and I see no reason for him not to be, at least in the match, he also has to be one of the favorites. And I think in either scenario, if you have The Rock in the ring with them there at the end, and they did not win, I don't think the crowd would take very kindly to that. What I don't want to see is Triple H sabotage the Royal Rumble match the way that Vince McMahon did in 2014 and 2015. That was self-sabotage. There was even a way to let Roman Reigns win in 2015 without pissing off the audience the way they did by dumping Daniel Bryan so early in the match, and they did it anyway. They did it anyway. It's like I said last week, they have booked themselves into a corner by not splitting the championships by now. There was a time where they could have done it early enough going into WrestleMania season. They didn't do it. Now, there really is no good way to do it before WrestleMania. I mean, they could do whatever they want. They could show up on television this week, have Triple H come out and say, hey, we're splitting the title. Technically, they can do whatever the fuck they want. But there really is no good way to do it right now, logically, before WrestleMania. So you have Roman Reigns going into WrestleMania as the undisputed champion with a potential match against The Rock that does not need to be contested for either of those championships. I also don't think Roman Reigns should be walking out of WrestleMania for the third straight year as a heel, retaining his title. So what do you do? If The Rock does not work WrestleMania this year, it's a pretty open and shut case. Cody Rhodes should win the Royal Rumble. Cody Rhodes should challenge Roman Reigns at WrestleMania and win the championship. Very straightforward. If The Rock does work a match with Roman Reigns at WrestleMania, he does not have to win the Royal Rumble. I am not a big fan of having Roman Reigns wrestle both nights, but you have him wrestle The Rock on night one and win. And then he goes on, and by the way, I mean, this is even better if you think about it, because what he does then is he goes on to defend his titles on night two against the winner of the Royal Rumble. So you can maintain that stipulation that the winner of the Royal Rumble gets the main event of WrestleMania, and that person beats Roman Reigns. With Roman Reigns beating The Rock, right, the biggest star in the world, beating The Rock the night before, it only enhances Roman Reigns, and therefore enhances the person who beats him the very next night. Because the guy who beat The Rock just got beat by the winner of the Royal Rumble. And you have Reigns wrestle on both nights. That would be the logical way to go about doing that. And you give people a Roman Reigns match on both nights. He's the biggest star in the company. Right? You may have people going to night one of WrestleMania and not night two, or vice versa. So you can look at it that way as well. You can't split the titles between both nights. So, for example, he defends one title on night one and the other title on night two. You can't do that, because when Roman finally loses, when he finally takes that first pinfall loss in more than 3 years. He has not been pinned since December of 2019 by Baron Corbin. Okay, when he finally eats that pin, he needs to drop all the gold, not just one of them. He drops one, he still has this other championship if it's the Universal title, and his reign continues. But you've already beaten him. The mystique is gone. So when he loses, he has to lose. He has to lose it all. And if Triple H is planning to do a draft after WrestleMania, that's the perfect time to split the titles again if they want to. Sami Zayn is going to get the shot against Roman at Elimination Chamber in Montreal, which is already sold out, by the way. And that's a big building. The Bell Center is a big building. I don't know how much of it is going to be tarped off for production purposes, but that's a big building. Over 2 months to go, not a single match announced, and they've already sold out the building. I think all but the most expensive platinum seats. Those might still be there. But those will be gone too, very quickly. Sold out to see Sami Zayn try to take the championships away from the Tribal Chief. But he will fall. And then we go on to Sami and Kevin Owens against the Usos at WrestleMania. So the pieces are finally falling into place. But this Rock stuff, you know, him entering in number 30 and winning, remember, just because it's being discussed does not mean that it is etched in a stone tablet. Brian Gewirtz, who is very close with The Rock, still works with him, I think on a production end, and was the head writer for WWE for many years, saw a tweet about this being, this whole thing being discussed, the ideas being discussed. And he tweeted about other things that were, quote, discussed during his time in WWE, such as, for instance, Vince McMahon having a midlife crisis, growing a beard, wearing Hawaiian shirts, and singing Black Eyed Peas songs. Or Caval being revealed as The Undertaker's secret long-lost son. Or John Cena losing to Bray Wyatt by way of a singing-possessed child. And then he said, oh, wait, that one actually happened. And Bray tweeted back, he said, yes. Yes, it did. I need to know more about that Caval idea. I may have to go to Low Key at the next House of Glory show and just ask him if he ever heard anything about that. That would have been wild. The point is, lots of things get discussed. Very few of them ever make it onto the air. I'm hoping this is one of those times. If The Rock is in the Royal Rumble, he wins. And The Rock should not win the Royal Rumble. From one former WWE writer, we go to another. Kazim Famuyide was on the Masked Man podcast on Thursday, and he said that he is hearing the WWE will be hosting a big show in Puerto Rico sometime between the Royal Rumble and WrestleMania. So basically somewhere between January and March is that this show would take place, and it would be headlined by a tag team match with Damian Priest and Dominic Mysterio against Rey Mysterio and Bad Bunny. Now, Dominic Mysterio here, fresh off of attacking his father at home because he dared to put the Christmas tree up before Thanksgiving. That's what he said on The Bump this week. And the idea is that the tag team match would then lead to a singles match at WrestleMania that would pit Dominic against Bad Bunny. Now, he said those plans might have to change due to Rey being injured. We saw Rey in a walking boot on Thanksgiving when Dominic and Rhea Ripley, you know, beat him up. He was supposed to be in the World Cup tournament on SmackDown. He got replaced at the very last minute by Mustafa Ali, who wrestled Ricochet instead. And at the time, what I read was that it wasn't considered to be a serious injury. If they're talking about WrestleMania plans having to be changed because Rey is hurt, then maybe the injury is more serious than expected, because otherwise that doesn't make any sense. And if they're planning a tag team match with him before WrestleMania, then it really doesn't make any sense. So I'm not exactly sure of his injury status or that it's all that serious, because then he wouldn't be able to do anything at all. If it's a minor injury that he should be back from soon, again, why would that impact WrestleMania or a Puerto Rico show in January or February or March? Unless they're doing the show in January, and then I guess maybe the injury is such that he won't be cleared in time, possibly. That could be why they even filmed the Thanksgiving video at all. You know, they had Dominic break a broomstick over Rey's foot, maybe as a way to keep him out a little bit longer. At the Survivor Series press conference, if you remember, Issa NYC Demon Diva, asked Triple H the question at the very end about the success of their international shows, like Clash at the Castle, and obviously the Saudi Arabia shows do big business for them, and asked about doing more of them. And that's where Triple H, at the end of his answer, he kind of winked at her and said, stay tuned, about Puerto Rico. And I don't even know if she brought up Puerto Rico specifically, but he said, stay tuned about Puerto Rico. So there's definitely something going on there. WWE has run plenty of live events in Puerto Rico before. I know they ran one there last October. They ran their first New Year's Revolution pay-per-view there in San Juan back in 2005, as far as major pay-per-views or major shows go. Bad Bunny, you know, Bad Bunny was born there. He's a native of Puerto Rico. He's one of the biggest musicians in the world. So a Bad Bunny match in Puerto Rico would probably be an instant, not even probably, it would be an instant sellout. I don't know why I'm saying probably. It would be an instant sellout. He had one match. He had one match at WrestleMania last year. He tagged with Damian Priest against The Miz and John Morrison, and he was very impressive. Very similar to the Logan Paul thing at WrestleMania this year. That was his first match, also a tag match. In this case, he tagged with The Miz against Rey and Dominik. And a tag team match is a smart way to debut some of these people because, you know, they're not experienced wrestlers. And so you want to try to hide whatever weaknesses they may have, let them share in the work instead of putting it all on their shoulders, which is what makes Logan Paul that much more impressive to me. That at SummerSlam, they threw him in there in a singles match with The Miz, and he killed it. And then they threw him in there with the biggest star in the entire company for the championship at Crown Jewel, and he killed it. Logan Paul is the best celebrity acquisition that they have had. And I say acquisition, he's actually signed a contract with them. But even just as a one-time celebrity they brought in to do a match of some kind, Logan Paul is the best one that they've ever brought in. I mean, he is, you know, he's a natural athlete. He has an aptitude for it. Bad Bunny is similar in that he had the one match. I'm not going to say he's better than Logan Paul, but he went in there. He didn't embarrass himself. He did a few impressive things in that match, and he looked good. He was said to be very respectful to everybody. He's a legitimate wrestling fan. He put the work in the weeks leading up to the show. And, you know, again, with him and Logan Paul, they have two celebrities who really knocked it out of the park. But he's been on tour. He's been on tour. And that tour wraps up this Saturday in Mexico City, which would then free him up to wrestle. I assume the timing is perfect for this. 44 million followers on Instagram this guy has. This guy is smashing records left and right. On his most recent tour, he sold almost 1 million tickets. 1 million tickets. That breaks down to 45,000 tickets per show, or $11 million a night. He's the only artist to have ever performed $200 million tours in the same year. So Bad Bunny is a big deal. The match at WrestleMania, though, should be Rey Mysterio against Dominic Mysterio. That's my beef here with what I'm reading. They could have Bad Bunny in Rey's corner. They could have Damian Priest in Dom's corner. Unless, you know, if Rey is hurt, then obviously Bad Bunny standing in for him against Dominic would be fine. But the match should be Rey finally agreeing to wrestle his son one-on-one for the very first time. You know, Dom's been growing that mullet out lately to an obnoxious length. It was very noticeable on Raw this week. There may be a reason for that. That hair may be getting chopped off at WrestleMania. But they had Ricochet and Santos Escobar in the finals of the SmackDown World Cup on Friday night. With Ricochet winning the trophy, he's going to challenge Gunther in 2 weeks for the Intercontinental title. Escobar is one who I want to see in a program next year with Rey Mysterio. That's a match I have on my to-do list for 2023 if I'm Triple H. Per PW Insider, Eric Young is returning to WWE. He just finished up with the last set of Impact tapings. They wrote him out of the show in a very Lucha Underground-esque way this week. We saw plenty of murders on Lucha Underground. We saw people having their faces eaten off. I miss Lucha Underground. Impact has not shied away from murder before either. I remember when Mickie James was pushed to her death onto a set of train tracks. I know a couple of years ago they had, what was it, John E. Bravo was shot during a wedding segment they did. I remember Tommy Dreamer sitting over his body screaming, no, like Darth Vader. I don't think he was killed. I think he just ended up in a coma. But here, Impact, they did leave the door open, possibly, for Eric Young to still be alive. We never actually saw his dead body after the deed was done. He has to be alive, otherwise that would be a very awkward Hall of Fame induction when he inevitably returns to Impact. But it's not often I watch Impact anymore. You guys, if you're a longtime listener of the show, and I know we have a lot of longtime listeners and diehard listeners, because, again, you've been sending me your Spotify Wrapped this week and fucking 20,000, 30,000 minutes. It's ridiculous. So you guys know I used to review Impact many years ago. I reviewed it when it wasn't great. I reviewed it when I thought for a period of time there, around 2012, 2013, there was a period of time where I thought it was better and more enjoyable than WWE. So I've had a love-hate relationship over the years with Impact, but I haven't paid much attention to it recently. But I watched this segment. They got me to watch Impact for this segment. Now, I know that Eric Young was the leader of the Violent by Design group. I know he's been leading that faction for a while. Cody Deaner is another member of that faction, or I guess now he's just Deaner. They shot this cinematic segment where they were visiting an abandoned prison somewhere in Tennessee. And I guess at some point in the past, this was where he once purged Deaner of the sickness. And he was questioning him here about the sickness. It was like an interrogation almost. And Eric Young placed a knife on the table in front of them. And he told Deaner he told Deaner the sickness was in the room with them. But he was referring to himself as the sickness. And it took Deaner a little while to kind of realize what he was saying. And then he realized it. So to eliminate the sickness, Deaner would have to stab Eric Young to death. And a fight broke out. He beat the shit out of Eric Young. And then he plunged the knife into his chest. So the idea is that he killed him. You know, when Impact writes people out of their storylines, they go all the way with it. None of this loser leaves town shit. Or hitting somebody in the back of the head with a pair of brass knucks. Impact just takes it to another level here. Now, I assume the WWE has signed him as a talent. I believe the last time he was in the company, he was doing some producing behind the scenes for them before they let him go. So I say again, I'm assuming he's being brought in as a talent and not just to be in a backstage role, where I'm sure he could contribute in a backstage role. You know, he's a veteran guy. But Triple H, you know, he brought him into NXT many years ago. And, you know, Eric Young headed up the Sanity faction with Killian Dane, Alexander Wolf, Nikki Cross. And then Sanity got called up to the SmackDown brand in 2018. And Vince McMahon proceeded to bury them. They never stood a chance. I will never understand that. From the moment they brought Sanity in, I think even in their very first match, or Eric Young's very first match, I think they lost. I'll never understand that. I'll never understand why you would build up an act here in your developmental brand, bring them up to the main roster, and just bury the fuck out of them like that. So he ended up getting drafted to the Raw brand. He was released as part of their COVID budget cuts in 2020. Hey, get out of here, Johnny. In 2020. You know, look, I know people like Eric Young. I don't have anything personally against Eric Young. I don't see the need for this. I read this news. I said, Eric Young. Of all the people Triple H is bringing back to the company, Eric Young. Like, I don't see the need for this. Again, unless they want to use him as an agent or a coach. I was never really a big fan. And I didn't like Sanity either, but they at least deserved a chance. Like, I made that very clear when I was reviewing NXT even years ago before they got called up. I said, I'm not a Sanity guy. I'm not a Sanity guy. So when they got called up, I wasn't heartbroken. I wasn't devastated to see that it didn't go anywhere. But I also said, look, they never even gave these guys a chance to get over. I felt bad for them. But this is Triple H bringing back the people he signed that Vince McMahon took a giant crap on, like Tegan Nox. Tegan Nox is another one. She just returned Friday night on SmackDown in the most anticlimactic way possible. He threw her out there cold to no reaction. They're repackaging Lacey Evans for the third or fourth time with more vignettes, but someone like Tegan Knox could have used some videos more than Lacey Evans. We already know who Lacey Evans is. We don't need videos for Lacey Evans. We sat through 8 fucking weeks of videos for Lacey Evans. Someone like Tegan Knox, who a lot of people don't know or don't remember, could use that, and he just throws her out there on TV as if we're supposed to remember who she is. I remember who she is. Didn't sound like the crowd in, where were they, Buffalo on Friday? Didn't sound like they knew, or they did, and they didn't care. Now, Tegan was released a year ago. She's been having visa issues ever since. She couldn't legally work in this country while that was being sorted out. So she's been, you know, at home playing video games and streaming on Twitch. The question mark on her is her knees. Can they hold up? She's had ACL surgery on both knees. In fact, I think on one of the knees, she's had the ACL surgery more than once, I believe. She was going to win the Mae Young Classic years ago before her knee exploded in the match that she had with Rhea Ripley at Full Sail. I hope she can stay healthy. She came to Liv Morgan's aid on Friday night against Damage Control, so it looks like they're going to build maybe her and Liv up as a team to challenge Dakota Kai and Io Sky for the tag team titles at some point in the near future. There's another former TNA star who I thought may be on his way back to TV soon, but as it turns out, it's going to be a long time before we see him again. And that is Bobby Roode. On September 29th, Roode posted some photos to his Instagram from a trip that he made to Southlake Orthopedics, saying that he was headed home after what he hoped to be a successful trip to Birmingham, Alabama, and he thanked the Andrews Sports Medicine team there for taking care of him. He included a photo in a hospital gown on a gurney. It was either right before or right after some sort of procedure. There was a second photo showing 2 little dot band-aids on the side of his neck. But he gave no indication of what he was there for. There was no context. It was just, thank you for taking care of me. Here's some pictures, but I'm not going to tell you what's wrong. So, yeah, you see the 2 band-aids on the side of his neck, and you assume, okay, it must be neck-related. But we didn't know, right? He gave no indication. Since then, he was spotted backstage at the November 11th SmackDown, but he wasn't used on TV. And again, nobody knew why he was there. Now comes the news from his Instagram with a photo of him in a hospital bed with a neck brace on that he just underwent neck fusion surgery. And he thanked his doctor and the staff in Birmingham and said, C5, C6 fusion is complete. Now the work begins, recovery and rehabilitation. Looking forward to the challenge. So now we know why he was in Birmingham in September. It had to do with his neck. Now, I don't know if they tried something in September to see if maybe they could avoid a more serious surgery and it didn't work. And so now he underwent the fusion, or if the trip in September was to sort of get him primed and ready for the eventual fusion. That I don't know. I'm assuming it's the latter, but I don't know for sure. But now he's going to be gone for a while. And Bobby Roode has been out for a while. He hasn't wrestled a match since the end of June. Bobby Roode has not won a match on TV since January. He hasn't won a singles match in WWE at all in nearly 3 years. Almost for as long as Roman Reigns has gone unpinned, Bobby Roode has not even won a singles match on TV. You'd have to go all the way back to February of 2020 when he beat Kofi Kingston on SmackDown. That was before the COVID shutdown. All that to say that Bobby Roode has not done a damn thing on the main roster since he got called up. And I know, the dirty dogs and all that. He hasn't done anything of note since he got called up to the main roster. And I was hoping that would change under Triple H. Triple H is the one who brought him into NXT in the first place. I enjoyed his run in NXT. And I enjoyed his work in Impact too. Again, when I was watching Impact at the time when I thought they were actually more entertaining than what I was seeing on Raw and SmackDown, that was around the time that Roode was probably doing the Dirty Heels team with Austin Aries, before Aries just completely went off the reservation there. So I've enjoyed Roode's work for a number of years, and he's older now. He's a lot older now than he was back then. But I was hoping, all right, he's a Triple H guy. Triple H is in charge now. He's bringing back certain people. He's pushing certain people maybe who weren't being pushed before. In some cases, it's not working. You look at what's going on, for example, with Hit Row. Dexter Lumis, that remains to be seen. He just won a contract on Monday night against The Miz, so he is officially now a member of the Raw brand. A lot of these people have been hit or miss so far, but I was hoping Rude might get the chance. Unfortunately, it's going to be a while before we see him again. And that's a tough surgery for anyone. You hear about any kind of spinal fusion, that's a tough surgery anyway. But especially for someone who's 46 years old. You know, if he wants to make a comeback in the ring, I hope he can do it. Shout out to the Lightning Link Lounge. If you like playing games online and you want to try to win some money, the Lightning Link Lounge is the place to be. You can play slots, you can play Keno, poker games like Texas Hold'em, blackjack, and roulette. There's thousands of games to choose from and they pay winners daily. For more information, search for Lightning Link Lounge on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok. You must be 18 years or older to play. Ages may vary outside the U.S., and ID is required. So text 727-910-8809 to get started. Now let's switch over to AEW, although this does tie into WWE. This was another big story this week. And that is the status of one William Regal, who appears to be gone from AEW and on his way back to WWE. Now, there has been a lot of rumors and speculation all week long, especially since the angle they did with him on Dynamite about what his future would be in this company. Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful, many days ago, said that talent is of the belief that William Regal's AEW deal could be up in December of this year. And he said that this was also being speculated at last weekend's WrestleCade event. Mike Johnson, a PW Insider, chimed in a few days later, saying all signs are that William Regal will be WWE-bound very shortly. Although we have heard nothing official from the company, there have been rumblings within WWE of late about Regal returning in a backstage role. And Johnson posted an update this morning, actually right around the time I was getting ready to sit down and record this, that according to PW Insider, Regal is finalizing a new deal with WWE and is currently expected to officially start after the new year. And it is expected that it will be in a backstage role. And so then we get to this week's Wrestling Observer. And I know Meltzer has kind of been all over the place with this, but this was the update on the William Regal situation from this week's Observer. Said that this appeared to set up, when he says this meaning Regal helping MJF win at Full Gear. This appeared to set up Regal and MJF as the heel unit on top, similar to the 2021 pairing with Kenny Omega and Don Callis. It was said that when Regal signed that he had a 3-year deal. There have been a number of different stories, but the one said by somebody involved in the deal is that it was actually a short-term deal that is about to expire, and he is expected to be returning to WWE. Multiple WWE sources said Regal had an out clause in his contract. Actually, the returning to WWE is basically a given at this point, whether it was a short-term deal or Tony Khan let him out of his deal out of respect for him. There had been a lot of talk this past week regarding his future and a potential return, even before Paul Levesque tweeted a Regal clip from NXT talking about war games from the past. Those in WWE noted that Levesque, when he started in WCW, that Regal and Terry Taylor always looked out for him and taught him, and that he will always take care of both of them if he has the power to do so. Stories were going around regarding his future this past week, which makes the entire pay-per-view finish confusing. The idea is to build a major program with MJF and Bryan Danielson for the championship, and MJF putting Regal out as the catalyst. And then he goes on here to say that he doesn't understand putting so much heel steam to the point of being the point man in taking the title from Moxley and helping to put it on MJF when they knew that he was gone in a few weeks. Apparently there was knowledge, at least on Tony Khan's part, that within a few weeks Regal was going to be out of the company. And he pointed out, you know, then you had MJF pretending to turn face, but then turning back heel. And you had Regal turning heel for 2 weeks, but then the idea was that he's the sympathetic babyface for being hit in the neck with his own brass knucks. Look, there's a lot of Jekyll and Hyde here when it comes to some of the booking with Tony Khan and AEW, but you look at what they did here with Regal, and I can defend it a little bit in this way. First of all, MJF was getting, you know, these huge babyface reactions since he came back from a lot of the crowds. And then they leaned into it, right? The stuff with the firm attacking him and him fighting back against the firm. They wanted you to think that this guy was going to be, you know, a big babyface. And that's what they were teasing. And then the pay-per-view came and we all realized that he's still the shithead that he's always been. And we've heard stories that MJF does not want to be a babyface. Apparently he told that to Chris Jericho and Jericho said, too bad, at some point you're going to have no choice because you're just going to be so over that the crowd is going to dictate that you need to be a babyface. And then it was funny in that post-show scrum at Brawl Out, Jericho, I think, made the comment like, that he told him, like, I'll teach you how to work babyface. Like, I got you, don't worry. I look at what they did with Regal, and in a sense, it makes sense in this way. Even if Tony Khan knew that William Regal was going to be leaving the company, if I'm Tony Khan, I'm thinking to myself, how do I get the most out of this guy before he leaves? What can we do with William Regal to really make an impact and get out of him what we can before he goes back to WWE? And so they were telling this story on television for weeks, and they had that promo segment weeks ago with MJF and Regal that was so great. It was one of the best promo segments, I think, in the history of Dynamite. And MJF gave the backstory. It's almost like his villain origin story, talking about how, you know, when I was younger and the emails and, you know, I was suicidal after you told me that I wasn't good enough and all of this stuff to kind of fill in the backstory for the MJF character. And if they wanted to keep him heel and make him the devil and make him this just unbelievable asshole, what better way than to use William Regal in the way that he used every other person in his career up to this point to get what he wanted? I made that comment the other night. I said, that's what MJF does. He uses people and he moves on. He did it with Cody Rhodes. He did it with Wardlow. He did it with the firm by having them basically hand him the poker chip, which got him a championship match. And then he used William Regal to win the championship. And then when he did not need him anymore, he got rid of him. That makes sense for the heel MJF character. And then he bashes Regal in the back of the head with the brass knucks on Wednesday and leaves him laying. And they did this big serious injury angle. Bryan Danielson comes running out with one shoe on because he was caught off guard. He was in the trainer's room. And it was pretty clear at that point with Danielson running out and going in the ambulance with Regal, this was to set up an eventual match, probably for Revolution next year, with MJF defending the championship against Bryan Danielson. All of that makes sense. You can make sense out of all of that, right? It sets up MJF's first program. Regal was Danielson's mentor. He's trying to go for revenge for the Blackpool Combat Club, which is, it seems like it's all but done at this point. So that at least makes sense. The thing with MJF, you know, teasing that he's a babyface and then he goes right back to being a heel, to me, it reminds me almost of what WWE did with Steve Austin in 2001. Steve Austin went heel at WrestleMania 17, which ended up, even though we got some entertaining television out of it, although we also got the what chant, which is the worst fucking thing to happen in that company in years. But later on in that summer, they built to one of the greatest moments in Raw history. The return of the old Stone Cold. It was actually quite amazing to look back on this because as much as there were so many things about that invasion I hated and they dropped the ball on, we got back-to-back episodes of Raw in the summer of 2001. I think it was the July 9th episode and then the July 16th episode. The July 9th episode was the night that, you know, Paul Heyman stood up from the announce desk and they did that little ECW reunion until they killed it at the end of the show by announcing that Stephanie McMahon was the new owner of ECW. But then the following week is when they did that show-long storyline leading into the Invasion pay-per-view, where Vince McMahon was trying to get Stone Cold to come back, the old Stone Cold, to lead the charge and lead Team WWF into battle at Invasion. And Austin wouldn't even listen to him. Austin was off in a bar somewhere drinking and playing pool. And they had all but given up on the idea that Austin was going to come back. And then they did that segment where I think The Undertaker wheeled in classy Freddie Blassie in his wheelchair. And he stood up out of his wheelchair. And Blassie was, I don't know how old he was at that point, 70s, 80s. And he rose from his chair and he got everybody just all pumped up, right? It was this great like little pep rally there. And I remember they cut to Austin and he's watching this on TV back at the bar playing pool. And you could see like the conflict in his head about what he should do. And I remember he threw the pool cue down and left. And you hear this eruption in the arena because they know, right? He's on his way back to the building. They built that so perfectly. When the glass shattered and he came out, it's one of the all-time great reactions. And here he's stomping down to the ring. Jim Ross is losing his mind. He's giving stunners to anything that moves. It was this great moment, only for them to completely undo it at Invasion when he went right back to being a heel and he cost Team WWF the match. And it took the air right out of the fucking place. Right? They had the old Stone Cold back. That's what people wanted to see. And they just turned him right back heel. Now, I'm not putting this on the same level as that, right? Because that's an all-time fucking angle right there. But it does remind me of that, where you clearly can see the fans wanted that new version of MJF. They wanted him to, if not a babyface, more of like an Austin-level tweener. And then they said, no, we're going to keep him as a heel, right? And I think it did take the wind out of the sails of the fans a little bit. He probably has more opponents as a heel than he does as a babyface. But, you know, as far as Regal goes, it sounds to me, the likeliest scenario, I think, because it's very weird to think he has a short-term deal. The guy just signed with them in, like, March. February or March. What did he sign? A 9-month contract? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. I think the likeliest scenario is that he had a multi-year deal, or maybe it was for a year. But he had an opt-out clause. Maybe with the idea that if Triple H did come back, even if it was just to run NXT again, that he could leave and go back and work for him and work for his friend. And now he's exercising that opt-out. Ric Flair had a handshake agreement with Vince McMahon after he signed with WWE that, you know, if at any point he was demoted down the card out of a main event spot, he could go back to work for WCW. And Vince McMahon honored that deal. And Flair, you know, did the job for Mr. Perfect on his way out. There was some sort of, not a non-compete, but he wasn't able to actually wrestle for a period of like 6 months or whatever it was. So he went back to WCW, but he was doing a talk show segment, a Flair for the Gold, for months. But Vince let him out and he went back to WCW. It was a gentleman's agreement. But the idea that Regal would have even thought to ask for that would have been almost inconceivable given where we were at the beginning of this year. Triple H suffers a near fatal heart attack last year. Vince McMahon almost completely dismantles Triple H's entire team, including, I mean, he kept a few people like Shawn Michaels, but even Regal, right, he got cut. And now we see how things turned out. Not only did Triple H come back, he got Vince McMahon's job, which nobody could have predicted would happen the way that it did and when it did. Years ago, of course, yeah, Triple H, he's the heir apparent. It's going to be Triple H and Stephanie taking over. If you would have asked me that question 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I would have been like, of course, yeah, that's how things are going to turn out, right? It's only a matter of when, not if. Didn't look that way over the past year. And then you look at the way things turned out. Who knows? They've been friends for decades. Maybe Triple H gave Regal a heads up and said, hey, don't count me out just yet. Don't stray too far. We just don't know. We don't know for sure unless Regal comments publicly on things. Maybe he will at some point because he's got a podcast, so everybody's got one. Maybe at some point on his podcast he'll comment on this. He doesn't strike me as the kind of person who really shares a lot of kind of inside baseball stuff on his personal, contract status, but maybe at some point he'll comment on this. But of all the crazy, insane stories that have happened in wrestling this year, it's like, why not add one more to the pile, right? William Regal is fired by WWE. He's hired by Tony Khan to come work for AEW. And before the year is even over, he ends up back in WWE. You gotta put this on the list with everything else that happened this year. That's just batshit crazy. Regal in a behind-the-scenes role as Triple H's right-hand man. Like what Pat Patterson was to Vince McMahon. That makes sense. Almost like his consigliere. That's kind of how I think Regal is going to be for Triple H. He'll be his Pat Patterson, in effect. But Regal was also the one general manager that I never got tired of seeing. Because we didn't get to see him all that much. He was the perfect general manager in NXT. As sick as I was of all the GMs and the GM concept on the main roster, that's the one GM that I never got tired of seeing. So the idea that they would make him a main roster GM is very appealing to me. If Triple H is going to do a draft, he's probably going to do his very first draft coming out of WrestleMania. I still don't know what the point of the draft even is when you have so much crossover back and forth between Mondays and Fridays. It seems kind of pointless to me, but I guess people get excited about it. So if he's going to do a draft, I think it would make sense to actually have a GM for each show, you know, with their own war rooms, and they can, you know, make trades during the course of the year. If that's the case, Regal would be the perfect person. I don't know if he wants that. I don't know if he wants to be on TV. I don't know if this, you know, opt-out or whatever it is with him leaving AEW means he can't be on TV, but he can only work behind the scenes. That I don't know. But him as a GM for Raw or SmackDown, I think would be fantastic. Now, Brian Alvarez was speculating this week that Regal may also want to go back to be in Florida and not have to travel. And maybe that's one of the reasons why he wanted out of AEW. But he was traveling a lot to independent shows for WWE to scout talent. So that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. He almost makes it sound like Regal was just stationary in one place in Florida at the PC. How many times do we see pictures of him or hear stories that, oh, Regal was spotted at this independent show. He was spotted at PWG and Evolve and all. I mean, it's not like he wasn't traveling. How much was he traveling for AEW, for God's sake? He was traveling once a week. It's not like he was on the road all the time for AEW. So that to me doesn't make a whole lot of sense. His real value, in all honesty, as much as I'd love to see him as a character on TV, like a GM, his real value may be in talent development. Now keep in mind, his son also wrestles for NXT as Charlie Dempsey. And you can tell just by taking one look at this kid, you can't not see William Regal when you look at his face and the way that he wrestles. It's pretty clear whose kid he is. Maybe part of it is that he just wants to be around his kid to help in his development. You know, maybe in the end it all comes down to family. But AEW's loss is WWE's gain, just like WWE's loss at the beginning of this year was AEW's gain. Now the script has been flipped. Dustin Rhodes announced Saturday that 2023 is going to be his last year inside the wrestling ring. He made the announcement at Saturday's Blizzard Brawl event for Great Lakes Championship Wrestling. He is going to be 54 years old next year, and he can still go at a high level. And you look at the body of his career, he has had a hell of a career as far as longevity goes. You know, he debuted back in 1988 from the natural Dustin Rhodes to Goldust in WWE. There was a second run as Goldust that saw him have that very entertaining run as a tag team with Booker T. And then a third run, a decade after that. And he was tagging with his brother against The Shield. That battleground match in 2013 against Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins is one of my favorite things. All the way through to his Double or Nothing match with Cody 3 years ago, which I had the pleasure of being in the third row live to see. It was a hell of a match. And it is still one of the top three matches, I believe, in AEW history. He's a Hall of Famer for sure, and will certainly be in there one day. The latest on CM Punk, per The Observer, is that he remains under contract to AEW, and those close to him say the holdup on his being released is all on the AEW side, as he is ready and willing to, quote, move on to his next project, end quote. Tony Khan has three options here. Option A, he brings CM Punk back when he is cleared to wrestle again. This is the least likely of all the options. Option B, if Punk is the one pushing for a buyout, then Tony buys him out early and they part ways. Or option C, he waits until Punk is healed up from his injury and then he lets him go to avoid firing him while he's out hurt. There could be another consideration for why Tony Khan has not parted ways with CM Punk, though. AEW confirmed to the Sports Keto website this week that Punk is still in the Fight Forever video game that's coming out next year, which I assumed he would be. He may not be on the cover anymore, but I expected him to stay in the game. I mean, Cody Rhodes is still in the game. Kenny Omega confirmed that months ago. So if Cody Rhodes is in the game, I mean, why wouldn't CM Punk be in the game? But if Punk were to exit on bad terms, it could be that maybe they're waiting until after the game comes out, just in case they're, you know, were to be any issues maybe with the rights to his likeness. I don't know how that all works. But that could be a consideration here for Tony Khan. I can't wait to see what Punk does in media scrum mode in the game. Now, man, that's going to be fun. That's going to make for some very entertaining Sound of Gamer videos. You know, Kenny Omega had a hand in the development of this game. So maybe, you know, Punk eats a poison muffin and he shits himself, you know, like he did in WWE. You got to watch out for that Omega guy. I don't trust this guy. He'll add the buckshot lariat as one of Punk's signature moves, but every time he goes to do it, he lands on his ass and he gets pinned. Andrade, El Idolo. We have not seen Andrade or heard much from him or about him since he got sent home after his backstage fight, if you can call it a fight, with Sammy Guevara. But he is going to be out for quite some time because he is injured. And this injury is due to a torn pectoral muscle that he suffered actually a few months ago. Now, he took to Instagram, he posted a picture of himself from his hospital saying that he just underwent surgery. He says, "My first surgery, I can't believe it happened. A few months ago, I tore my pectoral muscle. I could and wanted to finish my match. I kept working because I love the business, but we know that many people do not value your effort. These days off, I took the opportunity to go to Dr. Well, to go to the doctor." He wrote, "Go to doctor," and then he put hashtag Andrade. I almost read that as Dr. Andrade. Dr. Andrade El Idolo. So anyway, he underwent surgery for a torn pec. A torn pec, unless your name is John Cena, is usually an extended layoff. Yeah, John Cena has the mutant healing powers. So he tore his pec. He was back within 3 months. Andrade may be gone for significantly longer than 3 months, but he posted a clip of the moment where he got injured. And he got injured during a trios match against the Elite. And there was a spot where they did a triple suplex, where all six guys ended up in the middle of the ring. They were jockeying for position. And then they suplexed, a triple suplex spot on the heels. So a simple suplex spot. I say this sometimes, like, the most serious of injuries can happen on the simplest of spots. This was not some kind of a complicated spot or any kind of an aerial dive or a dive out of the ring. This was a simple suplex spot, and he tore his pack. That's how John Cena tore his pack, on an arm drag, I think, in his match with Kennedy. Simple maneuver. You know, one of those things. What are you going to do? So anyway, he's going to be gone for a while. It's not like AEW was doing anything with him anyway. It's like, oh, Andrade's going to miss 6 months or 9 months from AEW. Is anybody going to notice? You know, I mean, Tony Khan didn't exactly have him involved in anything overly interesting or exciting when we did get to see him on TV. Now, at least he got television time. I can't say the same for Miro. I have no idea what's going on with Miro. The Miro stuff, that makes no sense to me. The Miro stuff makes absolutely no sense to me. If he's not hurt, and he's not off filming roles for other TV shows and preoccupied. And frankly, even if he had other stuff going on, he's been out of work here for so long. If I'm Tony Khan, I'm telling him, get your ass back to work. But it doesn't seem like that's the issue. He's ready and willing to come back to work. I don't know why Tony Khan won't use him. It is the most bizarre thing to me. Why is he even there? Why is he under contract? And it's always these cryptic messages from if not Miro, Lana is saying something. It's like, use the guy or get rid of him. I don't understand what the situation is with him. They brought him back at one point, and then he just fucking disappeared again. An injury would be the only logical explanation for it, and it doesn't sound like that's the case. I don't get it. I just don't understand that. The ratings for Dynamite this week were down from their Thanksgiving Eve episode. It was the second lowest Wednesday night audience for the show since June 15th, and the lowest Wednesday night demo number, 0.26, in nearly 2 years. I smell another Tony Khan major announcement. Major announcement tease coming soon. You know, are people getting tired of seeing the Elite and Death Triangle every week? Yes. Yes, and this was inevitable here. You do a best of seven series. Yeah, I enjoyed the first match very much. Even the matches they've had up to this point. They tried to differentiate the one on Wednesday a little bit by making it more of a brawl at the beginning. You have to differentiate them in some way so they don't all look the same. Because the championship is not on the line in every match, you're already losing the drama of, you know, every pinfall, every submission attempt. You know, you could have a new champion, right? You've eliminated that. It's like a slow-moving, extended Iron Man match. And there's a reason they don't do too many Iron Man matches on television. Because traditionally, they don't always do very well. Although, from what I remember, I think the Bryan Danielson-Hangman Page one actually did do well last year. I think they did build their audience with it. But anyway, so yes, are people getting tired of seeing this match? Yes. And you know it's going to go the full seven matches. This thing is going to go for many more weeks. And they're going to have to find different ways to keep people, interested in what they're doing here, because you're going to have fatigue. You're already seeing fatigue, I think, with a lot of fans, seeing the same match over and over. Now, they put that match in the main event spot on Wednesday. And again, this show did not do all that well. So it'll be very interesting when they bring it back for a fourth match at the Winter is Coming show, what position they put that match in on the show. It should not be the main event. It should not be the main event, because you have MJF defending the championship against Ricky Starks. That is your main event. Do they open the show with it? Do they close out the first hour with the trios match? That would be the likely spot, I think, one of those two segments. The MJF promo that he did, where he talked about the bidding war of 2024, and he mentioned jolly old Saint Nick, Nick Khan, and he mentioned his boy Trips the Game, right, Triple H, at a time when a lot of people want to cheer for MJF. It's easy heat for him to go out there and talk about leaving and going to work for the competition, which is why he does it. And it made sense for him to do it when he wasn't the champion. But now that he is, I would keep those mentions to a minimum going forward. He could throw it out there, you know, here and there as we get closer, as we get deeper into 2023 and they want to tease the fact that maybe he's going to negotiate a better deal to go to WWE. For all we know, he's already locked and loaded. You know, Tony Khan may have already signed him to a... I know he's denied signing an extension. That doesn't mean that he hasn't signed an extension. So I think it's okay to kind of throw it out there where it's appropriate. But now that he's the champion, again, you got to keep that to a minimum going forward. I would not have him out there harping on this anymore, because it does make the company seem like the little brother to Big Brother. And AEW will always be the little brother to WWE. They're not going to overtake them. They're not going to overtake them business-wise. But going forward, they should not have their champion constantly drawing attention to the fact that, hey, I'm probably going to leave this fucking place, you know, a year from now. I'm going to leave this shithole to go work somewhere else, you know. Maybe tone that down a little bit. Now, there's one more Dynamite before Winter is Coming. One. That's it. We need a live contract signing with Ricky Starks and MJF. And it doesn't look like we're going to get one. Because Ricky Starks is in the Dynamite Diamond Ring Battle Royal this Wednesday. But it needs to happen. You have two of the best talkers in the company. How do you not put a live mic in their hands and stick them in the ring together? Send them out there to build interest in their match. In your final Dynamite appearance here, your final opportunity before their match of Winter is Coming. That would be a huge misfire by Tony Khan if he does not do this. And it doesn't have to be a contract signing. It could just be a normal promo segment. But Ricky Starks is in the Battle Royal, and so I question whether or not we'll even get that segment at all, but we should get that segment on Wednesday, because it would be fucking dumb not to do it. Now, Ricky Starks is in the Battle Royal. As I said, they're going to have other names announced between now and Wednesday. It's a Battle Royal where the winner can then challenge MJF for the right to win and then wear the Dynamite Diamond Ring. The Dynamite Diamond Ring gimmick has basically been a gimmick for MJF. He has won the ring every single time. He is a three-time winner of the Dynamite Diamond Ring. So this time it stands to reason that he'll probably lose. I thought he was going to lose it last year, so who the fuck knows. But at this point, I look at the Dynamite Diamond Ring stuff and I say, MJF has won the title. So many of his matches, he has used the Diamond Ring to win his matches and to gain an advantage on his opponent. It blew up in his face against CM Punk earlier in the year when Wardlow kind of accidentally on purpose handed it to Punk in the dog collar match, and Punk was able to use it against MJF. The gimmick doesn't serve any purpose anymore, especially after Full Gear. When he said, I'm not going to use the Diamond Ring, he used the Brass Knucks instead. Now he's the champion. He doesn't need the ring anymore. The ring does not need to exist. Because what are you going to do? You're going to put the ring on another heel? And then what? That heel is going to start using it to win their matches as if we haven't seen that before. Or if a babyface wins it, okay, it's a one-time gimmick, and then what? We don't hear about it for another year. It's a fucking ring. I don't think that there is a need for the Dynamite Diamond Ring at this point. It served a purpose with MJF. I think it has outlived its usefulness, and I don't see the point of this gimmick at all. I don't see the need to even do a battle royal for this. But they're doing a Dynamite Diamond Battle Royal. So, whatever. We'll see. Ricky Starks is in there. It would make sense for him to win. Doesn't mean that he will. They have Captain Sean Dean. I'm saluting as we speak. Captain Sean Dean is in the graphic for this Battle Royal. Captain Sean Dean. When was the last time we saw Sean Dean on Dynamite? I don't fucking remember. But he's got two wins over MJF. One by disqualification, which may be the only disqualification win in AEW history. I know there was a fall. It was an Iron Man match. I think a 30-minute Iron Man match with Pac and Kenny Omega in the early days of Dynamite. I think Pac won a fall by DQ, but that he didn't win the match by DQ. You don't see disqualifications in this company. I believe the one that we did see was Sean Dean beating MJF, and then he beat him by countout in another match. Two fluky wins. But if they have him in the graphic, then he's in the Battle Royal. And if he's in the Battle Royal, then there's got to be a reason why he's in the Battle Royal. I have no interest in Sean Dean winning the Battle Royal and then getting a match with the world champion. That would be fucking dumb. But in any event, he's on the graphic. I'm sure he's in the match. I watched Rampage. It was more of the same as far as being a completely missable show. Darby Allin looked like he may have lost a fingernail in his match with Cole Carter. He has challenged Samoa Joe to a TNT championship match for Dynamite this Wednesday. He says he's not leaving without getting his belt back. Joe against Darby, that's a great match. I'm looking forward to that. And the inevitable suicide dive where Joe sidesteps Darby as Darby crashes into the guardrail. I'd be very disappointed if we don't get that spot. Joe against Darby is great. Joe defending his Ring of Honor television title at Final Battle against Juice Robinson is just another one of these random Tony Khan matches. Robinson has officially signed with AEW. His first act as an official member of the roster was to challenge Joe for the television title. Joe took the TNT title from Wardlow without pinning him. Maybe Wardlow returns the favor and he costs Joe the TV title, which clears the way for him to focus on defending the TNT title. Because Joe doesn't need two belts. The only other time that we've seen Juice Robinson on TV was against Jon Moxley, the AEW World Champion, and he lost. I don't think another loss would serve him very well here. But I do like that we're getting more Samoa Joe. That's one thing I've asked for, and he is scheduled for two matches in less than a week, against Darby on Wednesday and then Juice on Saturday, so that I like. There was a quick backstage segment with Shane Taylor, the former Ring of Honor television champion, interrupting a Keith Lee interview. Lee and Taylor were a tag team for years. On the independent scene, they were a tag team in Ring of Honor before Lee signed with Evolve. How many people know that, though? How many people watched this and thought, what's the history with these? Who is this guy? And what's the history with these two? Suddenly, there's Shane Taylor, who's never appeared on an AEW show before, challenging Keith Lee to a tag team match at Final Battle with Shane Taylor and J.D. Griffey, who's never wrestled for Ring of Honor, let alone AEW outside of a few appearances on Dark, against Keith Lee and a partner of his choosing. Swerve Strickland walked up behind Lee with a smirk, an evil smirk on his face. So this is all in furtherance of the story with Lee and Swerve. They're digging into a part of Keith Lee's past, I guess. This was slapped together. This was so slapdash here, the way they put this together. It's so last minute because they realized, hey, we have a pay-per-view in a week. And they had like three matches announced for this fucking card. They go, we got to put a card together here. So let's fill this thing out a little bit. Griffey being thrown in there is totally random. But I guess they felt Taylor just, he needed a partner as an excuse to get Swerve and Lee together as partners. Because the story is about Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland. It's not really about Shane Taylor. It's about Lee and it's about Swerve. And if they're going to be reluctant partners, then they had to find somebody, I guess, to put in there with Shane Taylor. So we end up with J.D. Griffey. Maybe it's Swerve, you know, playing mind games with Keith Lee. But this was just, it was slapped together so suddenly. Tony Khan expects everybody to just hit the Google machine and find out the rest that they don't already know. Jeff Jarrett and Jay Lethal, they're a thing now. They got a win over Private Party, so we may be getting future AEW Tag Team Champion Jeff Jarrett, everybody. The Acclaimed called out their next challengers for the AEW Tag Team titles, which will be FTR. We are getting that match on Wednesday for the championship. So who interferes? Is it the Gun Boys? Is it Jarrett and Lethal? Maybe both? I don't see a clean finish to this one. We also have a Ring of Honor pay-per-view this Saturday, and the Ring of Honor Tag Team Champions are not on the show as of this moment. That could change come Wednesday, though. I'll tell you one thing I am liking. I'm liking this new attitude from Athena and the way that she just beats the crap out of her opponents. She is challenging Mercedes Martinez at Final Battle for the Ring of Honor women's title. So that's the Ring of Honor women's title. Next Friday on Rampage, Hikaru Shida is defending her Regina D-Wave championship against the... The Regina D-Wave Championship against the Bunny. I just can't. Her Regina D-Wave title from the Pro Wrestling Wave promotion. And I know Pro Wrestling Wave. It's a legitimate promotion. Asuka, back in her days as Kana. I know she spent many years working there. I get that. Not crapping on Pro Wrestling Wave. Just saying. How many fucking championships must we see on this show? I cannot even keep track anymore. I'm just watching this promo inserted into the show, and Sheeta's challenging her. I'm going to put my Regina D-Wave... I'm like, Regina D... What? What is this? So we have a championship match. It's not an AEW title. It's not a Ring of Honor title, but we have a championship match. We have a championship match on Rampage next Friday. I can't. I just can't. Orange Cassidy, he retained his All-Atlantic Championship over QT Marshall. I just can't get over that. Oh, I'm crying here. If only you could see. He retained his All-Atlantic title over QT Marshall in a lumberjack match. That didn't matter. I mean, who cares about it? QT Marshall, who cares? What mattered was what happened after the match. When the House of Black showed up and they laid waste to all of the lumberjacks. And after the show was over, AEW posted footage online. The attack continued. And Malakai Black noticed Brandon Cutler was filming the action on his Cutler cam. So Brody King put him through a table, which is the only appropriate response when you see Brandon Cutler. And Malakai told Cutler that he had no problem with him, only the people that he associates himself with. I really hope they're not building up the House of Black right now just to feed them to the Elite. After the Elite win back the trio's titles from the Death Triangle, which they will. I hope they have more in mind for them than just feeding them to the Elite and moving on. Ring of Honor Final Battle is this Saturday, 4 p.m. Eastern start time, so it will not conflict with the NXT Deadline show at 8 p.m. And then there's a UFC pay-per-view at 10 p.m. I'm going to be out that day, so I'll cover whatever key stuff there is to cover. I'll cover it on 786 next Sunday, because I'm not going to be around on Saturday. But I look at this card, and I'm predicting a clean sweep of new champions. Fuck it. Change them all. Change them all. I think Wardlow costs Joe the TV title. Juice Robinson will be the new television champion. I would like to see Athena take the women's title from Mercedes Martinez. So I think Athena wins. I think Wheeler Yuta takes the pure title from Daniel Garcia. And I think that Claudio wins the Ring of Honor World Championship back from Chris Jericho. The stipulation is that if Claudio loses, he has to join the Jericho Appreciation Society. I don't want to see that. The feud with the Jericho Appreciation Society and the Blackpool Combat Club has now stretched into its 7th month. 7 months of this. The key word in Final Battle is final. This should be the end of it, with Claudio getting the happy moment to close out the show and getting redemption for how Jericho took the title from him back at Grand Slam. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. December is here, it's the season of giving, and we're not just talking YouTube memberships or Regina D-Wave Regina D-Wave championship matches. Oh, no. But, you know who you've already given enough to? Your internet service provider. That is, if you haven't already been using ExpressVPN every time that you've gone online this year. Every time you go online without ExpressVPN, your provider, like AT&T or Verizon, can see and log every single website that you visit. And yes, that includes all the sites that you visit in incognito mode. That's why when I go online, I do so with ExpressVPN. The app encrypts and reroutes all of my network data through their secure servers so my provider can't see a thing. And it couldn't be easier to use. Just fire up ExpressVPN on any of your devices, your phone, your laptop, your tablet. Tap one button to connect, and that's it. You're good to go, and you can browse with peace of mind. Unlike your internet service provider, ExpressVPN is committed to your privacy. Their privacy policy has even been audited by third parties so you can rest assured that your data is not being logged by anyone. You've given enough to your ISP this year. It's time for you to start taking. So take back your internet privacy today with the VPN rated number one by TechRadar and Mashable. Visit expressvpn.com/solemonster and get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/solemonster. expressvpn.com/solemonster to learn more. NXT. Most of the participants in the men's and women's Iron Survivor matches at NXT Deadline were announced on Tuesday. There was a show-long storyline where Shawn Michaels invited four WWE Hall of Famers who never came out before the live crowd to sit with him in a boardroom backstage to go through the NXT roster and decide who deserved to participate in both Iron Survivor matches on December 10th. It's coming up next Saturday. This is their new scramble match concept with the penalty box to replace War Games. The winner of the men's match will earn a shot at the NXT Championship, and the winner of the women's match will earn the right to challenge Mandy Rose for her NXT Women's Championship, both at a later date to be determined. So we had Road Dogg, X-Pac, Alundra Blaze, and Molly Holly. They all seemed reasonably familiar with the product, either that or they were prepped very well. Road Dogg works for WWE, as does Molly, so I would expect them both to know a lot of the faces at the Performance Center. Alundra Blaze probably not, although they did bring her in for a segment a few months ago. And I don't know how much Waltman keeps up with it. But I thought for the most part, the banter between them came off genuine. They had cutaways back to the boardroom several times throughout the show. And when it was over, the names they settled on for the men's match were Carmelo Hayes, which should be a no-brainer. You'd have to have no brain not to pick him. JD McDonagh, Grayson Waller, and Joe Gacy. With a triple threat wild card match on TV this Tuesday to determine the fifth member between Von Wagner, Axiom, and Andre Chase. On the women's side, we have Zoe Stark, Cora Jade, Roxanne Perez, and Kiana James. The triple threat wild card match this Tuesday for the fifth spot will be between Wendy Chu, Fallon Henley, and Indy Hartwell. They had 2 fucking hours to pick a fifth person, and they couldn't decide on one. I think Shawn Michaels needs to find some better people to bring in next time. The first thing that jumps out at me when I look at the field on the men's and the women's side is that they are dominated by heels. There is not a single babyface on the men's side, and the only babyface on the women's side is Roxanne Perez. Von Wagner would seem like a shoe-in on the men's side were it not for the fact that they have no babyfaces. So I think either Axiom or Andre Chase is going to squeak in, probably after Odyssey Jones costs Wagner the win, since it looks like the two of them are headed for a match. So I just think it's more likely Wagner and Odyssey have a singles match at Deadline than Wagner being involved in this. The women's wild card match, it's harder to predict, but I think Wendy Chu gets in since Cora Jade is already in the match. Again, this concept is an experiment. If it works, we'll see more of it, and they'll probably use it on the main roster at some point. If it fails, well, at least they tried something new, which is what they can use NXT for. It was also weird to hear them talking about Tony D'Angelo and how, well, you know, we can't really vote for him because he's been hurt and he may not be ready, and sometimes you have to protect the talent from themselves. And then later on in the same show, Tony D'Angelo says that he's been cleared and he's going to be back in the ring this Tuesday in a match. So that didn't make much sense. Roxanne pinned Indy Hartwell clean in Indy's best match in a long time. That's the best Indy Hartwell match I've seen in forever. Dijak had his first match since returning to NXT with a win over Dante Chen. He beat him easily with his Feast Your Eyes finish. Then they gave him a microphone after the match was over, and he called that an example of hard justice. Now he's naming old TNA pay-per-views. First they copy their King of the Mountain match, now they're stealing their pay-per-view names. If we see a barbed wire Christmas tree on TV at some point this month, I'm going to start asking questions. Are we sure that Abyss is not working behind the scenes now for Shawn Michaels? Because I know he works for them. Did they send him down from the main roster to work NXT? Dijak said that he's not reinventing himself. He's here to eviscerate a soft society. I wasn't a fan of the material they gave him. I thought he delivered it fine. I mean, he did what he could with it. Later in the show, he was in the parking lot leaving when he was confronted by Tony D'Angelo. I thought maybe they were going to reveal that they were working together after he attacked Wesley last week. It may end up that way. Dijak wasn't very friendly towards him, but D'Angelo brought up that he's returning to the ring next week and said that his goal is to see Wesley's reign as North American champion come to an end. And he asked Dijak if they have an understanding. And he responded with something like that, and then he walked away. My favorite thing on the show, though, was the diner segment with... I love diners, anyway. I was just at a diner last night, in fact. I was having some sliders and french fries at 2:30 in the morning. I love diners. They had a diner segment with Bron Breakker and Apollo Crews. Crews was sitting at a booth, about to enjoy his scrambled eggs and his toast. He was writing in his journal. When Bron showed up and sat across from him, he knows this is the diner that Apollo usually eats at. And they had a very natural, realistic-sounding conversation, as realistic and natural-sounding as you would expect in WWE. Bron ordered some coffee and talked about how Apollo coming back to NXT inspired him to work harder in the gym. Crews said that he's been doing the same. They're going to be wrestling each other at Deadline next weekend. Crews said that when Bron wrestled Von Wagner for the first time, he didn't have the size advantage, but he still had his speed. But against him, he's not going to have either one of those things. There was no yelling. A fight didn't break out in the middle of the diner, although that would have been fucking great. I would love to see a diner fight. It was a different kind of segment than we're used to seeing. And like the segment last week with Bron fishing on the lake, right? They're doing a good job of humanizing him because as good as he is this early in his career, he comes off very one-dimensional. And I think they know that, which is why they've been taking great pains to do these segments with him. And I think it's paying off. I think it's been very effective. They aired a vignette for a newcomer to NXT, who is a familiar face to NXT UK fans, however many of those are left. We have Aoife Valkyrie. She has not wrestled since last August. That's August of last year, not this year. She suffered a knee injury in a win over Ginny. Got hurt, hasn't been seen since. Now she's coming to NXT and she has a new name. No longer is she Aoife Valkyrie. Now she is Lyra Valkyria. She talked about watching the birds as a child, leaving... Fuck the birds, by the way. Leaving Ireland for a new place. And now she's leaving her homeland and she's shedding her feathers as new feathers emerge stronger. Who we once knew has shapeshifted to a new form. So now we have shapeshifting here in the new NXT. She had a win streak going for over a year in NXT UK until she lost to Meiko Satomura. They've been adding talent to the women's division recently from the UK brand. We had Alba Fire, right? Then Isla Dawn showed up a few weeks ago to feud with Alba Fire. And now we have Lyra Valkyria. You line them up, and they all fall to Mandy Rose. Toxic Attraction beat Caden Carter, Katana Chance, and Nikita Koloff. I almost said Nikita Koloff. Oh, I'm getting ahead of myself here. I'm about to talk about Jim Crockett Promotions for the Tales from the Territories review, so I have Nikita Koloff on my mind. just the idea that Mandy Rose would have beaten Nikita Koloff. Maybe one day in Be the Booker, if we do like an intergender... I don't know what I'm saying. This is what happens when you're up at 2:30 in the morning at a fucking diner and you go to bed at 4. I'm a little off my game here. But no, Toxic Attraction beat Caden Carter, Katana Chance, and Nikita Lyons. What is wrong with me? Oh, they attacked Nikita's knee earlier in the show, but she was cleared to work the main event, and so they came out, they did the match in the main event after all. And she lost to a high-low from Gigi Dolin and JC Jane. Not a very good high-low, but that's what it was. They're building Nikita up for a championship match with Mandy Rose. But the woman who ought to be taking the title from Mandy Rose is Roxanne Perez. Of the names in that Iron Survivor match, she's the one. She's my pick. She's my prediction. But she's the one that I would pick to go all the way and dethrone Mandy. And not because I think Roxanne Perez should have a long extended run as the NXT Women's Champion, but I think she's the perfect babyface to topple Mandy Rose, to take the championship from Mandy before ultimately the championship goes to Tiffany Stratton. She's the one who I think... You're not going to have Tiffany Stratton as the heel beat Mandy Rose. Roxanne Perez, perfect person to take the title from Mandy, but then in the end, at some point... Maybe WrestleMania weekend, I don't know. But Tiffany Stratton is going to be your new NXT Women's Champion before long. Mark my words. This week's Tales from the Territories was the penultimate episode of the season covering Jim Crockett Promotions and the evil heels of the Carolinas. This is the one that I was looking forward to probably the most. I really enjoyed it. It did not have much in the way of new stories to offer, though, except for the Nikita Lyons one. No, the Nikita Koloff one. I won't make that mistake again. The Nikita Koloff one about the screen test for Rocky IV. I guess he's told the story before, but that I had never heard that story before. The round table was Arn Anderson, Ricky Morton, Baby Doll, and David Crockett, with Jim Cornette and Nikita Koloff interviewed separately. They were not with the others at the round table. They were interviewed individually. Cornette doesn't surprise me since he hasn't left his house since the pandemic started. He just doesn't travel anymore. We got a brief history lesson of Crockett Promotions, or Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling as it was known at the time. Jim Crockett Sr. made Dusty Rhodes the booker, and Crockett became known as a heel territory, very heel-heavy. Arn Anderson called 1985 to 1988 the golden era of wrestling and said that it will never be topped. He said it will always be the greatest era of wrestling. I don't disagree that nothing will ever top 1980s pro wrestling. I won't limit it to 85 to 88. I'll just say that nothing will ever top 1980s wrestling. You get no disagreement from me on that. I grew up in the Northeast watching the WWF. But I would get glimpses of the NWA when I would be in my grandparents' house since they had cable and we didn't. I thought the Road Warriors looked cool, but I never really got into it until years later. That's when I gained an appreciation for how fucking great Crockett was, right? With the Horsemen and the Road Warriors and the Steiners and Dusty and Luger and Sting, and Vader came later on, but it was great. Cornette was a heat magnet back then. He was a heat-seeking missile. Still is today. And never even has to leave his house. People would throw all kinds of things at him. Bottles, rocks, eggs, tennis balls. Which actually kind of makes sense if you think about it. He said he was the only civilian at one point to have to wear a bulletproof vest to go to work. One common theme of these territories episodes is how much people believed back then. And even the ones who knew or kind of knew what wrestling really was, if you were that good at your job, you could rile them up so much that they would want to kill you. Like, literally kill you. They would try to attack you coming through the crowd, leaving the building and the parking lot. Like, these people took it very seriously. There was an angle where Cornette hit Baby Doll in the stomach with his tennis racket. And the announcers told the people that, well, she may never be able to have children as a result. And Cornette cut a promo right after and said, good, nobody wanted a thing like that to reproduce anyway. It's like, the things they got away with back then, that was heat. That was real heat. And when Baby Doll eventually got her revenge, the angle they did was they put a noose over Cornette's neck. And they tied him to the back of a pickup truck out back. And they had a signal that when they banged on the truck, I think two times, she would hit the gas and take off. Now, Cornette got his thumb under the noose at the very last second, just in case. And in all the excitement, Baby Doll took off a little too early. So because Cornette got his thumb under the noose, he was able to slip out of it quickly. Had he not done so, she would have taken his head clear off his shoulders. And you hear stories like this, or you watch the angle where Eddie Gilbert hit Jerry Lawler with his car, and you appreciate the lengths that they went to make it all seem real. There were no stuntmen involved. You were one wrong move away from tragedy. You know, you had to make it look good. You had to make it look real, because if not, you could lose the people. And if you lost the people, you didn't have guaranteed television money to fall back on if they stopped buying tickets. You didn't have all the merch money they have now. You didn't have $50 million for a Saudi Arabia show. Fans buying tickets, that was how that you paid the bills and paid the talent. You know, when I talked about Portland Wrestling and Don Owen a couple of weeks ago, there was no contract with the television station. There was no money being exchanged. The television show was a free advertisement for their live events. That's how you made your money. So there was this need to protect the business. You had to protect kayfabe. Baby Doll was second generation. Her mother and father were both wrestlers. Her father promoted shows in Texas as well. So she got her start in world class as a valet for Gino Hernandez. Michael Hayes is the one who told her, hey, call Dusty. And she called Dusty and he said, hey, when can you start? And she started in the Carolinas. And she was such a good heel. She had a pregnant woman at one point standing on a chair in the crowd, reaching over and grabbing her by the hair, trying to get her one night. And she turned around to go strike her in the stomach, only at the last second she realized that the woman was pregnant. And she was able to stop herself in time before she could really hit her. She almost hit a pregnant lady. And she said she couldn't understand why is this woman, if she's so pregnant, why would she be standing on a chair trying to grab at me? And Arn Anderson is sitting right there next to her at the round table. And he just says, because you were good at your job. They covered the famous angle at the Omni in Atlanta, which Arn said was his favorite all-time wrestling venue. It was dark. Everything was black except the lights over the ring. It's not surprising to me at all that Triple H used that same kind of lighting on a lot of the black and gold NXT takeovers, as someone who grew up watching Flair and the Horsemen and Dusty. This was the night where Dusty saved Ric Flair from a beatdown by the Koloffs after his cage match against Nikita. But then Flair turned on Dusty and joined with Arn and Ole Anderson in the cage and beating Dusty down. They broke his ankle. This was the formation of the Four Horsemen. I mean, Arn wouldn't name it until a promo later on, but this was basically the genesis here of the Four Horsemen and the alliance between Flair and the Andersons. And the first time where when the babyfaces hit the cage to try to get inside and save the day, they couldn't. You know, the fans were used to seeing the heels getting their comeuppance and the babyfaces would come out and save the day. That didn't happen here. And, you know, the heels beat them back. Every time they tried to climb over the cage, they'd knock them down. And actually, now that I say that out loud, very similar to the angle they did after the Bret Hart-Owen Hart cage match at SummerSlam in 94. Maybe that's where they got it from. We had Hart family members scaling the cage, the Bulldog scaling the cage, all the Hart brothers trying to get inside, and Owen and Anvil inside are knocking them down, right? It's classic pro wrestling. And so the heels beat them back. There was a riot in the building. Ole had seen things like this happen before. And he told Arn, let's get the hell out of here, because he could see this was going to a bad place. But the fans were right up against the cage. There was no guardrail holding them back. There were about 10 Atlanta police officers who finally showed up. They escorted them out of the cage, but they had to get through the crowd to get to the locker room. So were the officers not there, things would have turned out very badly for these men. Arn said it was the only time in his life in a wrestling setting where he thought he was going to die. They were able to get to the back. They were all bleeding. None of it was from anything that happened in the cage. You know, to be a heel in the territory days, you really did have to watch your back. They talked about Starrcade 86, the night of the Skywalkers. The night that Jim Cornette fell from the scaffold 20 feet above the ring and blew out both his knees. There was a scaffold match between the Road Warriors and the Midnight Express. Road Warrior Hawk wrestled that match coming in with a broken leg, which they did not mention here. But he had a broken leg coming into this match. He climbed up on top of that thing and wrestled with a broken leg. I hate scaffold matches. I have never seen a single scaffold match that I liked or that I thought was anything but shit. You can tell the guys up there are scared to death, so everybody is moving in slow motion because they don't want to fall. And unless someone does fall, there's no reason to be excited. It's all based around who's going to fall and kill themselves, basically. Nobody even talks about this match, the match itself. They talk about Cornette falling. That's all they talk about. Arn said the Night of the Skywalkers was a battle between the Booker and the boys over who was going to be going up on that scaffold. So he makes it sound like they didn't have the match announced in advance. I'm not sure about that. But Arn said that he would never do it. And they all agreed this is not safe. The original idea that Dusty pitched was that after the match, Cornette would throw his legs up, he would fall backwards like a cheerleader, and the Midnights and Big Bubba Rogers was with them as their bodyguard, they would all be down below to catch him. Cornette gets there, he looks at this thing, he sees how high the scaffold is, and he said, I'm going to kill these guys if I fall that way, we can't do this. So he came up with the idea of just dropping down feet first. He would drop down. Well, first of all, he would drop to his stomach on top of the scaffold, and very slowly, kind of, as Road Warrior Animal was like struggling with him, he would kind of position his body to now he's dangling underneath the scaffold. He's hanging, right, by his arms. And then what would happen is, as he would dangle there for a little while, he would swing back and forth. At just the right moment, he would let go, and Big Bubba would catch him. All Bubba had to do, Bubba was a big guy, all Bubba had to do was just stand there, put his arms out, and catch this guy. Well, Bubba did not catch this guy. He was 3 feet off, and Cornette fell straight down and blew out both his knees, including his ACL. This is a famous quote from Big Bubba after it was over. Jimmy, you fell so fast. That's what he told Cornette. He also tore all the ligaments in his knee that keep it attached to the femur and the tibia. Basically, he obliterated the meniscus is what he did. The surgery on his right knee, he said it cost him, and he said this in other interviews, not here on the show, but he said the surgery on his right knee cost him $1,500 because he had insurance, but that was his deductible. I know all about that. But it was just a scope. He never actually had the knee fixed because it would have kept him out of work for at least 6 months. And he couldn't afford to take that much time off. Back then, if you didn't work, you didn't get paid. So he paid for them to just scope it and just cut off all the little nerve endings that were floating around in there because that's what was causing him the pain. So they chopped all those off. So all these years, he's had no ACL in that knee. And he has said in other interviews that that knee actually feels better today than the other knee that he had ACL surgery on years later, which is now his bad knee. So go figure. We got some tales from Nikita Koloff, and it's still a trip to hear him speak like a normal person now after watching him on TV doing the Russian accent. Even wrestlers in the business thought they had a real Russian working in the Carolinas, but he was born Scott Simpson. He played football in Minnesota. He had a full head of hair. But they brought him in at the height of the Cold War as this Russian badass, and they had him shave his head. And he stayed in full gimmick all the time, right down to not speaking any English when he would be out in public or at a restaurant. He let his uncle Ivan, who he was traveling with, Ivan Koloff would do all the talking for him. He said that he even got a subscription to Pravda magazine so that the mailman would see it and think, wow, this dude really is Russian. I guess in case he was a wrestling fan, he wouldn't suspect anything. He lived the gimmick 24/7, even backstage, to where Cornette said Arn Anderson one day in the back told him, you can drop the accent now. We all know that you're from Minnesota. You don't have to do it around us. He claims he went so far as to have Lithuania listed as the birthplace on his daughter's birth certificate when she was born and they were in the hospital. One story I did not know is that Nikita screen tested with Sylvester Stallone for the part of Ivan Drago in Rocky IV. He did not get the part, obviously. If he did, who knows where his career could have ended up. Hogan as Thunderlips in Rocky III was huge for him. The backstory, which they, again, did not get into here, but I'll fill in the gaps. Had to do some homework on this because I'm fascinated by stories like this that I've never heard of before. Terry Funk had become friends with Sylvester Stallone, who was friendly with a lot of wrestlers back then. Like I said, they cast Hogan in Rocky III, so it's not much of a stretch to think that he would have cast another wrestler in Rocky IV. Stallone did a film in 1978 called Paradise Alley. And there are a ton of wrestlers in that movie, including Terry Funk. Ted DiBiase is in there, Dick Murdoch, Ray Stevens. I think Haku is in that movie. Stallone reached out to Terry Funk and said, look, I'm doing a Russian character in this new Rocky movie. Do you know of any Russians? Now, Funk didn't know of Nikita directly, but he had heard about him. And long story short, they ended up sending Nikita the script. He memorized all of his lines front and back. He would be riding in the car up and down the roads with Ivan Koloff memorizing his lines. They flew him out to Hollywood to screen test. He claims it was him. It was down to three people. Him, Kerry Von Erich, and Dolph Lundgren. They were the final three. I have no idea why they thought Kerry Von Erich would be good for the part of the evil Russian. He gets there, and Kerry asks him, are there lines that we're supposed to know for this? Nikita knew then and there, my chances just went up by like 50% here. He said, no way Kerry was getting the part. He didn't even know his lines. He goes, Kerry, what are you talking about? And then they send you a script. He goes, I don't know. You know, based on the stories of how he was back then, I would be surprised if Kerry Von Erich knew his own name. He said that at the end of the audition, Stallone told him, okay, I want you to turn to me at the very end, so we could have like a face-to-face, like we were in a real boxing match. So they yell cut at the end, and Nikita says, how was it? And they told him it was great, except for one thing. At the end, when you turned and you did the face-off, you completely blocked out Stallone. Because Nikita was gigantic back then. He was a monster. Stallone was probably 160, 170 pounds, legit. He was only 5'6". Nikita had to be every bit of 280 or 290 back then. I mean, you talk about swole. You go look at Nikita Koloff. As soon as they said that, he said he knew it was over. Even though they didn't call him back for a few weeks to give him the bad news, they said, we'll get back to you. He knew. He knew right then and there. He said, yeah, that's not going to be good for Stallone's ego. And that's probably not going to be good for my chances here. And they told him, they said, look, you nailed your lines, but the size difference between you two is just too unbelievable even for Hollywood. And keep in mind, in that movie, Rocky would have been in his mid-30s. So he's 35 years old with that much of a size difference. It just wasn't realistic to see him standing there in the ring with this guy. Lundgren was taller than Nikita, but he was probably 60 or 70 pounds lighter than Nikita was. And he was not as wide either. I mean, again, Nikita was like a fucking brick house, this guy. So he ended up getting, Lundgren ended up getting the part instead. And what an iconic part it was. But they told him that's the only reason you didn't get the role. They covered the famous plane crash in 1975, where Ric Flair broke his back, the plane crash that nearly changed the course of wrestling history. It was Ric Flair, David Crockett, Bob Bruggers, who was fairly new to the business, Mr. Wrestling Tim Woods, and Johnny Valentine. They were on a flight from Charlotte to a show in Wilmington, North Carolina. Jim Crockett sent his brother, David, on the flight to replace him at the very last minute. The pilot is this 28-year-old Vietnam veteran who made the decision to dump some fuel to allow them to take off because he had a plane full of pro wrestlers. It was too heavy. He had to dump some of the fuel. But he didn't distribute their weights evenly. So they didn't get into the details here, but what happened is Valentine noticed mid-flight that they were out of gas. And the pilot told them, oh, don't worry, you know, because my wing tanks are full. So it's all good. Then they started going down. It's all good until you start going down. Then you know something's wrong. The plane starts to, you know, descend, and the pilot just freaks out. And Johnny Valentine slaps him to try to get him to come to his senses and calm down. And he told people after the crash, he goes, had the pilot not panicked, they probably could have landed safely. Instead, they crashed 100 yards short of the runway. They narrowly missed slamming into a water tower. The pilot ended up in a coma. He died 2 months later. Bruggers never wrestled again. Valentine never wrestled again. They both broke their backs. Valentine ended up paralyzed. Flair broke his back in 3 places, but he was able to get back in the ring 4 months later. Flair was originally supposed to be sitting next to the pilot, not Johnny Valentine. Flair was up front. Valentine said that Flair was scared to be up there. He was whining about it. So he told Flair, get in the back, I'll sit up front. Imagine if Flair had stayed in the front seat. Jim Cornette said that it was Tim Woods who saved pro wrestling in the Carolinas, and not only saved pro wrestling in the Carolinas, but effectively saved what would later become WCW. You know, he was the lone babyface on the flight. Everybody else was a heel. If it had come out that he was traveling with the heels, it would have killed the territory. Remember, kayfabe. And Valentine was his mortal enemy, no less. So Woods was hurt in the crash. He had some broken ribs. He had some other minor injuries. His injuries were not as severe as the others. When police asked for their names, he gave his real name of George Wooden and claimed that he was a promoter, not a wrestler. In the hospital, he checked himself out early against doctor's orders. Some people were starting to put it together that, you know, George Wooden, is that Tim Woods? Was Tim Woods on the flight? So he showed up to wrestle 3 days later as Mr. Wrestling, like nothing had ever happened, even though he could barely move. Again, he had broken ribs. He could barely move. He did it to throw people off the scent and prove that he wasn't on the flight. How could he be on the flight? He's back in the ring wrestling. How could he have been in a plane crash? Today, he couldn't get away with that. People would be on TMZ with a list of every person on that flight within 5 minutes of it hitting the ground. And he probably cost himself money in the insurance settlement. You know, all the other wrestlers got money out of their settlements. Woods supposedly got little to nothing because he checked himself out of the hospital so early. All in the name of maintaining kayfabe. And like Cornette said, it probably saved the promotion, which would go on to become the only company that ever kicked Vince McMahon's ass. One last story that Ricky Morton shared, which Dutch Mantel goes into detail on in his book. I think it was in his book. He and Ricky have been friends for many years. And the story has to do with Ricky blaming Tully Blanchard for his marriage falling apart. Ricky was married with 3 kids at the time. And his wife had suspected in the past that, you know, he may have been sleeping around on her on the road, which of course he was. One half of the Rock and Roll Express getting, you know, all the attention from the ladies the way they were on the road in the 80s when wrestling was one giant party. I would be shocked if they weren't cheating on their wives. But every time she confronted him about it, Ricky would deny it and swore, I would never do that to you. I would never go behind your back and cheat on you. And she could never prove it, right? There were only suspicions that she had. She had been wanting him to accept God and Jesus and be born again, like Tully Blanchard did after years of living like a wild man. And she knew Ricky was friends with Tully, and she was hoping that he would follow in his path, I guess, but Ricky resisted. He didn't want to have any part of that. So then it just so happened one night that Tully was going to be live as a guest on the 700 Club with Pat Robertson. He was going to go on there. He was going to tell his story about how he became a child of God. I guess Ricky's wife was a regular viewer of the show, and when she saw that Tully was going to be on, she wanted Ricky to watch the show with her, figuring maybe this is the night that he would finally see the light, I guess. And he's like, sure, yeah, I'll watch it with you. Well, all was going well until Tully started talking about women and all the loose women that the wrestlers would party with. And Ricky knew, oh boy, this is not good. He was fine with the stories he was telling about the booze and the pills and the drugs, but this was a bridge too far. And he could see his wife's demeanor changing the more that Tully spoke. Here, you know, he thought all was well with him and his wife, finally, right? And now Tully is just fucking it all up by running his big fat mouth. And then it happened. He didn't just talk about the women, he named names. And the name that he named was Ricky Morton. He talked about naked women running around his hotel room and running back and forth between his room and Ricky Morton's room. Doing drugs and drinking and having sex all night long. So in the span of 30 seconds, Ricky's life went from the penthouse to the outhouse, and he knew that his marriage was over. He got busted. He got busted on live television, no less. I've searched for the video of Tully on the 700 Club. I can never find it. I've seen Sting on there, Lex Luger, Shawn Michaels. I can't find the Tully one. I would love to see that. So again, there were some fun stories and some stories about major events in history here that have been documented before, but I thought it was a fun episode. This Tuesday is the season finale covering Mid-South Wrestling. They've got an all-star panel with Jim Ross, Jake the Snake Roberts, Ted DiBiase, and Michael Hayes. I'm surprised they didn't get Jim Duggan for it, because he was a big part of Mid-South as well. And actually, his feud with DiBiase is legendary. And then the week after that, so that's the season finale for Tales from the Territories. The week after that, the Nine Lives of Vince McMahon documentary that was supposed to air on Vice in October, it's finally going to run. So that's going to be December 13th at 9 p.m. Eastern. Let's get into some... Again with this. Look at this. My fucking watch. Siri is giving me information on the Vince McMahon documentary. Shut the fuck up. I'm not going to tell you again. Doesn't listen. This is quickly becoming the greatest feud here of 2022. Solomonster and Siri. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Jad from London, England has an email here on what to do with Charlotte Flair. While I don't deny or ignore Charlotte's incredible talent as an in-ring performer, I have to admit that since her last showing at Backlash, I haven't really missed her. I don't hold her accountable, as I know it was down to Vince McMahon and the writing team in terms of how she carried herself on TV. But as a heel, she showed almost no weaknesses, and virtually every other woman not named Sasha Banks or Becky Lynch was made to feel less than. But the last time she was portrayed as a babyface, it was heavily implied that her father got Lacey Evans pregnant, so she was either on TV to the detriment of the entire division, or impossible to relate to and involved in storylines that nobody wanted to see. When Charlotte returns, what is the first program that you put her in? I saw that Charlotte was training, by the way, with Zoe Stark and Alba Fire in the ring this week. So she is on her way back imminently, it seems. If it's my decision, the WrestleMania match for the Raw Women's Championship is Bianca Belair defending against Rhea Ripley. And I would have Charlotte Flair working her first program back with Raquel Rodriguez on SmackDown. Charlotte comes back. She wants her belt back from Ronda Rousey. Ronda broke Raquel's arm, though. She wants Ronda first. She gets first dibs. Charlotte costs her the match, and it leads to a program between Charlotte and Raquel. Every time we see Charlotte, she's working on top for the title, and it's against a lot of the same faces. And I think that's also where a lot of the resentment comes from, that they always bring her back. I mean, it goes right back to how the Becky Lynch turn started in 2018, right? Charlotte was gone for a while. She came back, thrust right back into the women's title picture. It's almost like she usurped Becky at a time that the people wanted Becky to win the championship. And, you know, it ended up working out for them because Becky got over like crazy, I think, in a way they didn't expect. But you can find a lot of examples of this where Charlotte disappears, she comes back, and boom, she's right back in the title picture. That's where a lot of the resentment comes from. Raquel would be somebody new for her to work with. What do I think we're going to get? I think we're going to get Charlotte Flair challenging Bianca Belair at WrestleMania. That's what I think we're going to get. Because Rhea Ripley is going to be wrestling, I think, Beth Phoenix when she finally comes back. Maybe in Beth's retirement match. So WrestleMania next year would look like this. Ronda against Becky is probably what they're going to do. Charlotte against Bianca. And then it would be Rhea Ripley against Beth Phoenix. I don't hate the idea of Charlotte against Bianca. What we've seen from them in the few times they've been in the ring together has been very good. You know, story-wise, it's a simple story. Bianca has two wins over Charlotte, both by disqualification, so they don't really count. And the one other singles match that they had, which was in NXT, Charlotte won. So now here's a chance for Bianca to beat the last of the horsewomen. Bianca beat Sasha Banks at WrestleMania. Bianca beat Becky Lynch at WrestleMania. Bianca beat Bayley. Not at WrestleMania, but she still beat her multiple times. Charlotte is the one that she has never been able to pin. And those two WrestleMania matches were two of the best matches on those Mania, the ones with Bianca that I just mentioned, were two of the best matches that year at WrestleMania. If they do it, I would want to see Bianca go in there and beat Charlotte Flair, but then I remember WrestleMania 34 against Asuka. And I remember WrestleMania 36 against Rhea Ripley. And I remember WrestleMania 38 against Ronda Rousey. Maybe they come in twos. Maybe Bianca is safe so long as they do it at 39 and not 40. So I would prefer her against Rhea, but I think it's going to be Charlotte against Bianca at WrestleMania. Binder from Milwaukee. In the unfortunate event that Randy Orton has to retire, I think it would be a great opportunity to have a segment with Matt Riddle throwing a retirement party. Who would you like to see come out for this segment? Three obvious names are Triple H, Batista, and Ric Flair. You gotta have Edge out there, right? Rated RKO. Mick Foley, I think, is also a must, given how important he was in the early part of Randy Orton's career. Cody Rhodes. And in saying Cody Rhodes, I had this great idea. If Orton does come back, and I'm hoping he's able to make his way back. Maybe it takes a year, I don't know. But hopefully we have not seen the last of Randy Orton in the ring. If Orton is able to come back, a lot of people think he may not be able to. When the time comes that he is cleared to come back, what you do is you promote a retirement segment, like, or a party, whatever, just like you pitched, right? And Riddle can be the host. He could be the master of ceremonies. You bring out all of these names, Cody Rhodes being the last one. Maybe by that point, Cody is the WWE champion, right? So he's kind of a big deal now. A lot of history there. Orton mentored Cody as part of Legacy. Cody puts him over huge, right? Tears in his eyes and they hug. And then Randy Orton drops his ass with an RKO. It's the Mark Henry retirement all over again. And we get a Randy Orton-Cody Rhodes feud. It would be a shame if we didn't get Orton and Rhodes at some point with Cody being back now. You could do the same thing, by the way. Just substitute Riddle for Cody and have Orton lay out Riddle with an RKO. But Cody would be a bigger deal. You know, Riddle can stand there and be appalled and upset by what, you know, his friend Randy just went and did. He can be upset about that. But it gets you to Orton and Cody. And that would be, I think that would be a tremendous swerve. Daniel from Poland. He's been a listener since 2013. He has a question about WrestleMania 39. What do you think about an idea of making Stone Cold Steve Austin against John Cena, the Attitude Era against the Ruthless Aggression Era, an I Quit match? WWE could pay tribute to Bret Hart against Steve Austin and at the same time protect Austin's legacy by making him pass out to Cena's submission lock without saying the words I quit. I think Austin needs to be protected, and at the same time, John Cena needs a win after losing to The Undertaker, The Fiend, and Roman Reigns. It would seem to be a win-win situation. A safe submission match would save Austin from taking bumps and adding some drama because of Austin's history of neck problems. I don't disagree. Austin against Cena would be a huge match. And I think John Cena would be a very safe opponent for Steve Austin. That's why when people were like, oh, we got to get Austin if he comes back against Brock Lesnar, I go, why do you want to kill Steve Austin? Why do you hate Steve Austin so much? Maybe years ago that would have been a great match. Now I think it would be insane. So I don't disagree with you. Austin, Cena, you know, big match. The idea of making it an I Quit match, to me, I don't like that idea at all. First of all you're doing is just blatantly copying the finish to the WrestleMania 13 match. The reason the WrestleMania 13 finish worked so well was because of the blood. That's just the fact. The reason that finish worked as well as it did was because of the blood streaming down Steve Austin's face, dripping down his mouth, a pool of blood on the floor. That finish doesn't work nearly as well if you take the blood out of the equation. You're not getting blood. So already, you're giving us an inferior version of a finish to a classic match that we got years ago. The idea that you would have an I Quit match with either man even possibly saying the words I Quit is ridiculous. John Cena never said the words I Quit. I don't know why they would have him say I Quit now, and you're not going to have Steve Austin say it either. So no, I don't like the idea of this being an I Quit match. I 100% would not do that. That is not a good idea. You and I disagree on that, but Cena and Austin, could it happen? Yeah, it could happen. I still think that Austin's coming back. I think he's training for a comeback. It's just a matter of against who. Mark from Massachusetts, if Sasha Banks decides to return to wrestling, where do you think she ends up and where do you think it is best for her to be? Well, it's not my decision to make. Sasha Banks has to decide where she thinks it's best for her to be. I think if she comes back, she's back in WWE. If she comes back to wrestling, she will be wrestling in WWE. I think that is where she is going to end up. And honestly, I think it's the best place for her to be. I think with the level of competition they have for her, some of the names they have in the division that she has and hasn't worked with, people coming up from NXT, there's, I think, plenty of great matches for her to have. I think it's going to be the biggest platform for her. She gets to keep the Sasha Banks name and likeness and all that. I just think that's going to be the best place for her. Nick from Chicago, has Tony Khan dropped the ball with Hook? Yes. They were pushing him hard, and then they just stopped. You know, and I get he's still being developed. He's still very green. He's still very new to this. But the way they were pushing him, it was very odd how all of a sudden he's just been downgraded, if that's the right word for it, downgraded. You know, they've really cooled him off significantly. And I think there was the potential for him to be doing a lot more. And now it's like they're hiding him away almost, right? He had that initial push, and now it's like, all right, now we're going back to, you know, getting him prepped because he still has a lot to learn. But have they dropped the ball with him? Yeah, they have dropped the ball with him. Rick from Rensselaer, Indiana. Why isn't there more classic content on WWE Network like 80s FCW and AWA? And why isn't part one of AWA Superclash or all four Shea Stadium events on there? Very simple. Sadly, Rick, I saw Conrad Thompson say something about this just recently. People aren't watching the old content. They're not watching it. It's as simple as that. They still do some classic content drops. Every month they had eight or so new episodes of WWF Superstars they just posted. I think they're into 1996 now. They added a bunch of Canadian WWF house shows from the 80s last month, but they don't spend a lot of time on the classic content because people aren't watching it. I don't think they do a good job of promoting it on their television shows, but they have no incentive to do so now because they already have their money from Peacock. They have their guaranteed money from Peacock. It's on Peacock to promote the content now, not WWE. Right? I mean, if they promote the content, it really doesn't change their bottom line. They have their money. They're not going to waste television time to promote shows on there that are 30 or 40 years old. I've said before they should be doing a better job. This is before Peacock, of doing a better job to promote the classic pay-per-views and other classic content when they do these content dumps, even if it's just having a flashback segment, you know, coming out of a commercial break and then give a quick plug for the WWE Network. That was before Peacock gobbled them up and, you know, gave them $1 billion or whatever it was for 5 years. Now they have no incentive to do so. If they're not promoting it, people don't know it's there. Even if they did promote it, I don't know that people are going to be interested in it. I'm interested in it. I think it sucks that more people aren't, but that's just the reality. It's just the way it is. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I love hearing from all of you. I try to get to as many as I can. I'm sorry I cannot get to them all on the air or get back to you all directly, but I will try my best to do so. Follow me on Twitter, @Solemonster. Subscribe on YouTube. We are trying to get up to 72,000. That is our next goal, right? It was 70. Now we're trying to get to 71. Now we're trying to get to 72. I can't do it without you guys. The only way to do that is to sub. So subscribe to the channel. Consider becoming a channel member, as nearly 50 of you did over the course of this past week. Thank you very much for that. Thank you for all the Spotify Wrapped messages. Thank you for spending thousands of minutes and hours of your time this year listening to yours truly yak on about pro wrestling. Guess what? I'll be yakking some more next Sunday, because that's going to be episode 786 of The Sound Off. We have the usual live streams this week. Probably not going live for any of the shows on Saturday next weekend, Ring of Honor, NXT, because I'm going to be gone for a good chunk of the day. But we'll get to anything important that goes down. We'll get to that on the flagship show next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week, and I will see you live on Monday night on YouTube and back here next Sunday for episode 786 of The Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster Sounds Off.
There's Bret Hart, who I saw. He did a signing and was asked about who he would have loved to have worked with. But he name-dropped Kurt Angle, and he said Brock Lesnar. He would have loved to have worked with Brock Lesnar. From everything that he's ever heard about the guy, he's a total pro. Unlike Bill Goldberg. He had to slip that mention in there. Goldberg never even was brought up, but he had to slip that mention in there. I think it's fucking hilarious at this point. You could ask Bret about any subject. It doesn't even have to do with wrestling, and I guarantee you he will find a way to bring it back to Bill Goldberg. You could have Bret Hart walk into a Home Depot, and he's looking for some hardware. He's going to do some kind of DIY home building project, and he's in there, and he's looking for certain materials, and he's talking to the guy, and the guy says, "Yeah, I'm sorry, we're out of that. We don't have that color paint." And Bret just goes, "Man, you know, you disappointed. You disappointed me, kind of like Bill Goldberg did when he kicked my head in." And the guy just kind of looks at him and goes, "What the fuck are you talking about?" Literally any situation, he can bring up Bill Goldberg. I think it's fucking hilarious.
The Solemonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow The Solemonster on Twitter @Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Solemonster Sounds Off.